Hi everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of a Right Royal podcast. My name is Emmy, and if you haven't listened before, I'm usually one of the co-hosts on the show, but I'm also Hello's TV and film editor, which is why I'm flying solo today. There's a new Royal TV show coming out that I think you're all going to really love called Mary and George, and I'm going to be chatting all about it with the cast themselves. It's a historical period drama about the reign of King James I and his somewhat spicy relationship with George Villiers, the Countess of Buckingham's son. And I was lucky enough to sit down with the stars of the show, Still Alice actress Julianne Moore, Red, White and Royal Blues Nicholas Galatzine, and your Honour actor Tony Curran to discuss the show. Now, we're kicking things off with Tony, who listeners might know from Doctor Who as Van Gogh and Marvel's Secret Invasion as Derek. He's also set to star in the upcoming Outlander spin-off, and he will be starring in Mary and George as King James I. I've also heard that he's a bit of a history buff, so this should be a good chat. Tony, welcome to the podcast. So, what made you want to sign up for the project?
Well, it was the old way. It was auditioning, and I auditioned for King James and Oliver Hermanis, our fearless leader, director, offered me the role. Mm. So I was thrilled. And terrified at the same time, to be given the opportunity to play King James, a monarch who I knew a little bit about as growing up in Scotland, and basically by reading Benjamin Woolley's novel The King's Assassin and talking to him and quizzing him and having a lovely time asking and discussing about King James's reign and how his father Lord Darnley was assassinated before he was born. He was blown up in Scotland, how his mother was taken from Scotland, Mary Queen of Scots, and executed by Queen Elizabeth when he was 13 months old. He became King James VI of Scotland as an infant. So when I started delving into it, it was kind of mind-blowing in a way that I'd never known about this sort of monarch and about his life and his loves and his joys and his woes, and also the relationship that he had with the Villiers. And all three of them were buried half a mile away from here in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah.
Mary, George and James. It was unprecedented what he did. He cared about, loved George so much, cared about Mary, that he made them both, her the Duchess of Buckingham, him the Duke of Buckingham. And you're really not supposed to do that unless you're part of the monarchy. You can't become a Duke and a Duchess.
Wow.
He bestowed that honour upon them. It was an unprecedented move, basically. So that's what he thought of them. So I guess he liked them in
yeah,
that sense.
Yeah,
I guess he liked them, and the corresponding letters that I've read between James and George, he'd end his letters, you know, he'd say lovely things or he'd miss them, but then he would, you know, sign off with, you know, my dear sweet child and wife. That's what James used to say about George.
King James isn't massively, his stories aren't massively told in the media. They haven't been as much as maybe, you know, Henry VIII, Queen Elizabeth,
sure.
So on. But, like, so much cracks off.
Yeah, not so much.
And, like, I mean, you know, height of witchcraft, height of Shakespeare.
Indeed, yeah.
I mean, why do you think
incredible
that is?
Well, maybe there was an anti-Scottish feeling at the time. I mean, Mary, Queen of Scots, and her old alliance, her allegiance with the French, my mother, Queen Elizabeth, ultimately executed, decapitated Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
Because she did. She felt threatened that the Scottish army, maybe the French, you know, could assemble and try to, you know, depose her, take her off her throne.
Yeah.
So she felt that Mary was a threat. So, and then there's a gentleman called Henry Cecil, who's actually he knew Mary, he was a confidant of Queen Elizabeth, and it was on Queen Elizabeth's deathbed that they'd already suggested me becoming king, succeeding her, that she actually sort of decided, yes, okay, we'll give King James the opportunity to succeed me, and she made that decision.
Sounds so reluctant.
But so reluctant.
Fine.
Yes, like, all right.
I'm not going to live forever, is it?
Let the sweaty sock come down. You know, can you imagine at that time a Scotsman in the British or English court, and they go, who's becoming king now? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, King James the Sixth of Scotland. Oh, hang on. The man, the son of the woman that Queen Elizabeth executed is going to become king. So that must have been contentious. So the idea that they brought a Scottish king down to succeed Queen Elizabeth, the Baron Queen, as some have called her, 40 years on the throne without bearing any children or heirs, must have been a pretty intense decision. And but within that, you know, during his 20-year reign, he didn't. He wasn't a warring king. It was a time of peace. He brokered peace with France and Spain.
He was popular.
Yeah, in that sense, you know. Yeah. Whereas, but within history, in that sense, they talk about all this anti-Scottish sentiment. Also, that he was queer. You know, he was a queer Scottish king coming down to sit on an English throne who didn't want to go to war. And he didn't want to do that, you know. So, and also, he was queer. He was, maybe that's another reason that some of his reign has been swept under the under the rug. But I think there's a hypocrisy which is attached to that with, you know, we'll publicise their reign because, you know, they were, whatever, you know, whatever they thought about that time, but we'll sweep this monarch under the rug because it doesn't appear to, you know, keep up with our standards of what the monarchy should be.
Yeah.
As opposed to what the monarchy was.
It was kind of accepted. It was kind of common knowledge. Mm. And like, it wasn't, you know, pitchforks and torches. It was just a bit of banter, like a bit of jokes at his expense, poems at his expense, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, isn't that funny? Like, I mean, I just thought it was really interesting, though. It's like, because I guess it's not my perception of that time in history would have that response to it. But it was kind of accepted that that's who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, well, apparently, I mean, at times, I'm not saying they were having, like, you know, sensual, lascivious, you know, orgies in the streets, you know.
But
I think, but there was, it has been written that there was, obviously within our show, there's poetic license, but a lot of it is based on fact also, a dramatisation. Yeah, I mean, some might call it lewd, some might call it human expression, you know, an expression of desire. And if you do feel that stirring inside your loins, maybe as long as you're not harming anyone, then it is a natural human emotion. Maybe, you know, if we didn't feel those emotions, we might not exist in some ways, you know. So I think maybe, I'm not saying with Victoria, I'm not blaming or pointing the finger at Victorianism or the so-called sort of buttoned-up prudish nature of certain periods of history.
You can blame Victorianism if you like.
Yeah, no, maybe blame. Yeah, maybe. I just threw that one
in. Who's
getting
offended?
Maybe someone else could be like, no, Tony, you're totally wrong. We've always been prudish. We've always had it in our DNA. But and certainly the way it's depicted in our show, there's a sort of, you know, there's an enjoyment of the flesh, if you will.
Bodies are just bodies.
Bodies are just bodies, which is kind of a good line, you know.
Yeah.
But I guess bodies are just bodies, but bodies are currency as well in the world of Mary and George, because they can actually get you somewhere. And yeah, King James, you know, he has desires and he has these passions. But there's a line I use, it says sometimes in life, if you can't find meaning, you'll find distraction. And I think King James wants to find meaning, but I'm not entirely sure that he was entirely comfortable sitting on the throne. And sometimes he closed Parliament for 6 years. He'd always want to be going to see plays, writing with the arts, hunting, and obviously other pleasures, you might say, as well, as opposed to sort of governing and the pressures.
He's obsessed with witches as well.
Yeah, so, demonology, he wrote a book on it, yes. Yeah.
You know, I forgot until I was doing some research for this that I actually looked at that at uni. I did English literature and it was, you know, I think I was writing about Shakespeare and Macbeth, and it's, you know, Shakespeare wrote Macbeth because of his interest
in the opening three witches.
Queen Anne
tried to come over from Denmark twice. There was terrible storms in the Nordic Sea and she couldn't make it, so James sailed from Edinburgh and went to Copenhagen
To fetch her.
To fetch her. Mm. Apparently, that's where he learned to drink as well with with some of his Scandinavian cousins. But yeah, he blamed those two storms on these three women, which apparently were hung or burnt at the stake. And when Shakespeare heard about this, he had the idea, you know, when shall we three meet again? And thunder, lightning, or in rain, when the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won.
Do you think he was a good leader, though?
Yeah, I think he definitely had his faults. I think he was, but I really do think because we don't hear too much about him, like other monarchs maybe, that maybe he's somewhat unappreciated. The King James Bible, which he translated, which is still, if you go to New York or some hotel in America around there, and there'll be you open the drawer of a hotel, there'll be a King James Bible in there, which is kind of incredible.
That is amazing.
Jamestown, of course, is one of the first, the first British colony in the Americas and Virginia, and the Caribbean as well.
Also, this has just made me think that he's the king in Pocahontas. Just that's my childhood. That's brilliant.
It's
like Jamestown, I know that.
Yeah, Jamestown, right? Of course, the New World.
Yeah, there you go.
That's he was King James Stuart, 6th of Scotland, 1st of England, was the first anti-smoking campaign. If you will, a counterblast to tobacco. It was a leaflet that he wrote and sent it out because he hated smoking. He says, a custom loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs, and in the black stinking fume thereof, nearest resembling the horrible Stygian smoke of the pit that is bottomless. He wrote that, and I guess he wasn't fond of a cigarette.
What a modern guy.
What a sort of a progressive...
Yeah, I feel like he would have done very well in the 21st century.
Philosophy, yeah. So,
yeah.
But then...
Yeah, that's incredible.
He sent that out, but then he found out that fiscally, economically, this new leafy gold was going to be good for the coffers, so he sort of succumbed to it, you know, it became sort of economically so powerful, you know. Which, here we are today...
Capitalism strikes again.
Capitalism vaping away in the 21st century.
Well, I
digress. Yeah.
There's shortbread on the table, dear listeners.
Dear listeners, sorry about that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, do you think it will be a spoiler alert if we talk about how he dies?
No.
Yeah.
Because I can try and be as ambiguous as possible, but I'll probably put my big foot in it.
Was he murdered?
Good question.
I mean, the book's called The Assassination of King James.
It is, so there must be some sort of assassination going on.
Yeah.
There's talk that he had the gout, which is not a good sign.
Everyone gets the gout back in those days.
Back in the day, the old gout.
Yeah, go for a jog.
Loosen up. Do some Pilates or something, you know. Stretch it out, Jimmy.
You wanted to ban cigarettes, you could have found yoga.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I mean, if you're that progressive. I think there's talk that he could well have been poisoned. He may have died of natural causes. He was 58 years old when he died.
Mm.
He had trouble, with his body for his later years of his life. He was a drinker.
Mm.
He didn't smoke, obviously. But there is talk that he may have been poisoned. But the proof and whether it's fact or not seems to be up for debate.
Maybe
someone comes in and takes care of him in the middle of the night, you know. But what does happen in episode 7 in our show, I can't say whether he dies or not, what does happen, I think, is without trying to make it all histrionic and dramatic, which it is pretty compelling and extremely
dodgy.
Yeah, hardcore. Maybe with this subject matter, hardcore maybe is not the right term to use. But I think people are going to find it really. It's an incredible crescendo and dramatic ending to our piece, and it's very powerful indeed.
Well, let's get back to talking about his relationship with George Velez, and obviously in the show, very raunchy, like, you know, it's a very, very risque. I mean, how was it? Like, just tell me about how it was doing those scenes with Nicholas. Because I feel like I've been watching some BTS and, like, you guys clearly get along very well.
Yes.
So no, how did you work it out?
Indeed. Nick was great. We had a laugh. We started texting each other before I started, before we started shooting, before I'd even met him, actually. But I think it was certainly, from my perspective, to do sort of nude scenes or sex scenes. I don't mind if it's okay with the other people who are partaking it with, to have a bit of levity, because it breaks the ice, you know. Mm. And, you know, it can be a little noive-racking, dropping trow, dropping everything, actually. There was a scene I did with five other men, we were all completely naked. That was a first for me, and I was blindfolded as well.
Oh, episode two.
It was an interesting day. Now, there was something oddly liberating about it as well. But I guess once you get in the mindset of who you're playing, then you don't really think about how you look or what, you know, you just try to get into the moment, you know. And definitely with the scenes I had with Nick, because some of them were very affectionate and very tender, and were kissing each other and you know, touching each other. And it was just, we kind of trusted each other, trusted the director, and obviously trying to be as truthful and as we could with the scenes, because there's a lot of the scenes that are quite rough and ready and intense and raunchy and sort of fiery and sexual. But then I think the relationship falls into one of friendship, of tenderness, and ultimately of love. He's missing a longing in him in some ways for someone, for something, some intangible essence of something that can fill, you know, the hole he has in his heart or his soul, as it were. But whether or not that comes to pass, we'll soon find out.
Another thing I wanted to ask you is very impressive hair.
Oh, thank you, yes.
Was that, I mean, presumably you did not grow out.
No, I mean, I've had hair that long, but not that pretty.
It's glossy.
It is glossy. Yeah. We talked about it, tried different ones on, but then it just seemed to, it was such a Jacobean look. With the way I sort of, you know, shaped my face. And also, we did give my wig a name. We called her Margaret. For real. And she was a wee steel, scene-stealing...
It's my cat's name.
Oh, it is. Oh, lovely. I love that name. So, yeah. So, no, the wig, just the whole... It definitely got you into character. I felt it helped me anyway with the costumes. And I'm wearing a ring, actually, that I wore for the premiere last night, which Annie came over and she gave me. That was one of the rings I wore on the show.
I was thinking that looked quite kingly.
Yeah, it's quite kingly. So
very authentic.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah, it's good.
It's sort of a genuine, it's quite an old
a lot piece. Of detail.
Yeah. So I wore that as King James. But yeah, there was scenes I did at Hatfield House where I'd walk in, there was 120 supporting artists.
You know what I like about those days? All the roles were redheads.
There was a lot,
you know.
There was a lot of red. The more that, yes, quite right, as they should be.
I miss
be.
Those days.
Yeah, those days. Miss those days. Yeah. Well, we've got Harry.
Oh, that's
but
true.
Harry has the spare, as he calls himself. Yes, the spare has left the building. You know,
for now.
Sonia, for now. It's interesting, isn't it? I was listening to Harry's book on Audible about, you know, his plight and Lady Diana and everything that it went down. And some friends of mine are like, no, he just complains, he complains. And I'm like, he's expressing how he felt. But I think there's a candidness, I thought, to reading and listening to what he said. And he was, I think he was trying to be authentic. The royal family is very private, or tries to be. But yeah, the more redheads, the better.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, absolutely. Strongly. What do you think of the royal family nowadays?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, with Camilla is the queen, which is kind of like, oh my goodness. And then, yeah, I mean, I don't know if she did.
Lots changed.
Yeah. And, I mean, Queen Elizabeth passing, whether you're a like the monarchy or royalist or not, I don't think you can take away from the how incredibly committed Queen Elizabeth was to, I mean, how old was she when she became Queen? Was she a teenager?
26?
20s, and yeah. She was on the throne for 70 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's in itself is an incredible loyalty and commitment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, does it seem there's a change in the air with the monarchy, with King Charles? Fortunate King Charles has got cancer and he's not, you know, he's not well.
So soon
King,
after
King William, yeah. After soon after becoming king, King William could step into the fray as well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting the relationship between William and Harry, though, isn't it? It's sort of a.
Yeah, it's a shame.
It's a shame, isn't
yeah.
it? And how they kind of there's a. I mean, it's just, I'm sure it can be the same with a lot of families, but there's moments in the book when Lady Diana passed away and the way that Charles comes up to William and Harry and he tells them separately. Or moments where he'll come in and say goodnight and maybe he's, you know, Harry, or he's done some sporting event or some achievement that day, but he wrote a note. He didn't actually tell him, I'm proud of you, son, and I love
yeah.
you. And I think maybe that's, you know, how you behave when you're older, of course. It must relate back to how you were treated as a child. And, you know, the connection, you know, because of your childhood with your children can be tough. It can be hard to sort of bridge sometimes, which is a shame, really.
Generational trauma eking
yeah,
down from the 16th
goodness,
century.
Well,
last question.
Yes.
I can see we're wrapping up.
No.
Outlander, Blood
yeah.
of My Blood. I'm
yes.
so excited. Yeah, I mean, what can you tell us? When do you start filming?
Yeah, I've already started.
Oh,
I started
you have?
Last week.
Oh,
yeah.
Amazing.
I started last week with lovely Jamie Roy and Hermione Caulfield, who plays the mother of Catriona Balfe, Claire.
Right.
And Jamie is, I'm the grandfather of Jamie Fraser, and my son, Brian, played by Jamie, it's very confusing, is the father of Sam Hooyan.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we started shooting last week. I play a character called Lord Lovett, Simon Fraser. He was 80 when he died. He was one of the last men in the United Kingdom to be decapitated.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah, he fought in the Loddon. Spoiler alert, there you go. I don't know if we're going to get that far. I'll age up.
Thank you so much. That was so amazing.
It's lovely to talk to you.
Next up, I'll be joined by Academy Award-winning actress Julianne Moore and Bottoms and Red, White and Royal Blue star Nicholas Galatzine to talk all about their roles as Mary and George in the new show. Well, congratulations on the show. I've watched all the episodes that I've been allowed to, and I've absolutely loved it. Just wanted to open, how would you describe it to viewers?
We need to figure out a good elevator pitch for this. I would say it's a mother and son who, you know, whose family are potentially at risk of falling into oblivion, and this matriarch who sees potential in her son and has him sort of learn the ways of being a young Renaissance man to seduce the king of England and help elevate their family from potential obscurity.
Well done.
Is that good?
Yeah.
I've been passing that for days in my room.
I actually love seeing the mother and son dynamic because I don't think it's one that you see very often.
Certainly not like this.
No, yeah.
I mean, it's admittedly quite dysfunctional.
Yeah.
How did the two of you work on creating that dynamic? It was there.
It was there,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was beautifully written. It really was. I mean, these were two very interesting characters that existed in history and that Dave, you know, expanded upon and wrote for us. And so I feel like, you know, I feel like ultimately, you know, this is a show about relationships, about what people, how attached they are to each other, how much they can take advantage of one another, how dysfunctional it can be. I think what's compelling about history are really the people and the relationships.
Mm.
Yeah, and it seems like you guys hit it off right away. Yeah,
yeah.
She's a good mum.
She's a good mum, yeah. Maybe not in the script as much, but she's a great acting one, sure.
At Hello Magazine, we're actually doing a campaign about midlife for International Women's Day and really celebrating it as like a new start, something to be celebrated. I wanted to tie it in with Mary and George because obviously Mary has such agency in a time that would have been very difficult to have any. I mean, did that compel you to the role?
I wouldn't say that she has agency. I think that's why she is, why she strives so hard. She doesn't have agency. She doesn't have autonomy. She only has purchase in life through her marriages. Yeah, you know, so the minute, she has nothing. She has no property. She has no money. She has no position. So immediately on her husband's death, she has to find somebody else to marry so she could send her kid to France. So she's always like, how do I get from here to here? So it's either through, a marriage or a male child.
Yeah.
It's like she eventually sort of, you know, her daughter actually historically was well married eventually, and Mary sort of arranged that. But that was only because of George's position. Mm. So I think that the lesson of Mary, or the lens that we look at it, is like how much she managed to achieve when in fact she did have no autonomy. So how important autonomy is, really.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so unusual to be able to play a character, you know, like a conniving woman like she is in a period drama. So, I mean, did you just want to get your hands on it?
It was a wonderful piece of material. And I think what Dave wrote was so interesting and exciting and vital. The characters were very vital. And yeah, it was a fun thing to work on.
I know that you had to build Mary from the ground up because there's not a lot in the history books about her. Obviously, Nicholas, there's a lot more to be learned about George. I mean, did you like that you had something to fall back on? And same for you, Julian, did you like that you had to build her up? I mean, what would have been preferable?
You know, two different ways reaching the sort of similar result. I mean, I think that, you know, there obviously is a wealth of information about George, and we had a great text in The King's Assassin by Benjamin Woolley. But one thing I think Julie and I both keep coming back to is like the script. You know, script is the Bible, and I think there was so much there to sort of play around with and build upon. And so, you know, it's great knowing the history of it all, but really, there was just like a wealth of opportunity that I think existed within the script already.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, history saying that she's a witch, that's just harsh.
Well, I think it's untrue. Mm. I mean, I think we really don't know much about her. So I think what we do know is that she was buried in Westminster Abbey, which is a pretty major achievement, I think, in your culture.
No, definitely. Definitely.
Oh my God, so impressive.
Yeah.
Goals.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
And what was, it was a long shoot as well. I mean, what was the most memorable day for you guys?
I mean, it's hard to have a bigger day over 6 to 8 months.
Probably. I know. It was a long shoot. Maybe it was one of the days that the sun shined.
Oh my God, yeah.
It was really gloomy. It was very gloomy.
We had like a week of like torrential snow. It felt like rain. We had sun, but...
We had some hail.
I'd say, you know what, probably one of the big sort of banqueting days, because it was really nice when we had like all of the actors together. Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
And how do you think you two would have fared if you actually lived in this period?
Dead.
I would have died in childbirth, I'm convinced.
Yeah, she's childbirth. Yeah. I'm some sort of deadly disease at the time. Yeah. We're not making
that's
it
right.
past.
We're not made for, no.
You're both so cheerful.
We are made for
so
modern life and antibiotics and stuff.
Yeah. We're here for in the Jacobean era, we're here for a good time, not a long time.
My last question, what would you like viewers to take away from Mary and George?
I think I want them to be entertained. I really do. And learn a little bit about Jacobean history.
Right? There you go. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
So that's everything from me today. Thank you so much to all of our guests and to you too for joining us. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, catch more from Hello with our news and entertainment show, The Daily Lowdown, available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.